We're on. Okay. Hey, guys. Good morning. It's great to see you. It's great to be here in Paradise in person this year. So I hope you had a great time here in Maui and at the conference. My name is Dustin Williams. I'm an associate professor at UT Southwestern, where I also serve as the residency program director, which makes it doubly nice to be here today, right in the middle of our interview season. So it's a nice break. A nice break for me. And it's also great to be here to talk about one of my passions, which is ophthalmology or any ocular complaints. I really consider myself a total eye nerd. It didn't used to always be the case, though, specifically for neuro-ophthalmology. I think this is one of the most challenging topics in ophthalmology. And in medical school, I remember being completely scarred by this topic, right? Were these pictures of the eyes that go in all different directions for the exam? I just really tried to memorize the pictures and then ended up not doing so hot. And I think it was because I really couldn't put this topic into a clinical perspective. So I made it my mission to get it and to simplify it so that you guys feel a little bit more comfortable taking care of these patients in the emergency department. Like I said, I have no financial disclosures. I'm in academics. Another disclosure, I'm not an optometrist. I'm not an ophthalmologist. I'm just an ED doc that really likes eye complaints. Our objective today in the next 25 minutes, we're going to talk and review a basic approach to these patients who present to the emergency department with diplopia, talk about the differentials to think about when you see these patients, and also cover the common cranial nerve palsies that result in diplopia, as well as those mimics that sometimes can throw us off. And at the end of the talk, if you're still completely lost or confused, you're going to be in great company. Like I said, this is a hard topic. Anytime that you have where those specialties overlap, like neurology and ophthalmology, I really think those are like a watershed area where people really don't want to take ownership because it's pretty hard. Neurologists aren't as trained in those fine duction techniques that ophthalmologists are, and oftentimes, diplopia is a neurological problem. Ophthalmologists aren't neurologists. Ophthalmologists would much rather work up vision loss. That's a way easier complaint for them than diplopia. And the reason is because the differential is so incredibly vast. Right? When we talk about diplopia, we have things from dry eyes, astigmatism, all the way to things like brain tumors, aneurysms, and masses. Most of those things are not dangerous, but some of those are deadly. And in the emergency department, it's our job to rule out the badness. And usually, diplopia is a very prolonged workup and hard to get down to the answer. I don't want to scar you guys today, so we're not going to review the ocular mechanics and all those fine details from med school and the primary and the secondary action. But anytime we're talking about diplopia, I think it's important that we kind of cover the basics. So starting with cranial nerve 6, your abducens nerve. This one's pretty straightforward, right? A single nerve, a single muscle innervation. Your abducens nerve innervates the lateral rectus, so that's responsible for pulling your eyes temporally or to the side. Pretty straightforward. Next up, cranial nerve 4, our trochlear nerve, similar to cranial nerve 6, one nerve, one muscle innervation. But the trochlear nerve innervates the superior oblique muscle. And this one's a little bit tricky because it's on a pulley system, so it redirects the force. But the way I think of cranial nerve 4 and the superior oblique's purpose is intorsion of the eye. So it's basically rotating it in and down. So when you're trying to cross your eyes and look at your nose, that's cranial nerve 4. And last, but definitely not least, is cranial nerve 3. Cranial nerve 3 innervates the rest of your extraocular muscles, so it's very important. Not only does it innervate your extraocular muscles, it also has innervation to your levator palpebrae that keeps your eyelid up, which can be a clue to that diagnosis. So when these patients present to the emergency department, what's the first step in evaluating these patients? Well, we're worried about a neurological issue, like I said, when patients come in with diplopia. And so the first test is to check for ocular alignment, which sounds a little challenging, but it's actually really straightforward and simple. So you have a patient who presents to your emergency department, is complaining of diplopia. How do we check for ocular alignment? It's easy. We just have them cover one eye, the cover-uncover test. So in this patient, they presented with diplopia, they covered one eye, and then miraculously, the diplopia is still present only with one eye open. That's what's called a monocular diplopia. You can cross it over. Yeah, one eye open, one input, and you still have diplopia with one eye open. That's what's called monocular diplopia, and monocular diplopia is easy, right? Because it's not a neuro problem. When we talk about diplopia, we worry about a neurological problem, but when you have monocular diplopia, That problem is in front of the retina. This is strictly an eyeball problem. I love picking these up from the waiting room. If you have a really good triage nurse that can narrow it down to a monocular diplopia, I love picking that patient up because I can probably discharge them in just a couple of minutes because they don't need me. They need a comprehensive ocular exam. They need an ophthalmologist to follow up with. You know, whether that's an astigmatism, lens dislocation, not emergency medicine material, send them to the ophthalmologist. Eyeball problem, the refractive problem, is really beyond the scope of this lecture, but sometimes you can reassure your patient, right? They come in with monocular diplopia, they think they have a brain tumor, and you're like, you're just going to send me to the ophthalmologist? Sometimes you can remove that refractive error by having them look through a pinhole, right? So take a piece of paper, put a small hole in it, have them look through there. If it's a refractive error, that will help eliminate that, and the diplopia resolves by looking through a hole in a piece of paper. Your patient feels reassured and will follow up with the ophthalmologist. Once you've determined that it's a monocular diplopia, my anxiety level automatically decreases because it's not a neuro problem. They don't need a neuro eval. They need an ophthalmological evaluation. Contrast that with this second patient who presents with diplopia, right? We're going to first check for ocular alignment with a cover-uncover test, have them cover one eye. And in this patient, whenever they cover one eye, their diplopia magically resolves. It's gone. These people have binocular diplopia. Binocular diplopia can be bad. Binocular diplopia means that your eyes are not moving in synchrony together. And you guys remember from medical school, all those synapses and pathways, there's a lot of things that can go wrong in there to not make your eyes move in synchrony. And in the emergency department, that can be pretty subtle and difficult for us to diagnose. Binocular diplopia automatically increases my anxiety, like I said, because bad things can cause that and can be very, very subtle. We're only going to talk about isolated binocular diplopia in this lecture. We're not talking about folks who have other symptoms, like brainstem symptoms. If a patient presents with diplopia and associated vertigo, ataxia, weakness, right? These probably people need to have some sort of stroke workup, and that's beyond the scope of this lecture. We're only talking about isolated binocular diplopia here. It's also helpful in these patients that present with diplopia to get some context of what they're seeing. When a patient says that they're seeing double, well, what does that mean? Have them characterize that. What do the images look like to them? Are the images stacked on top of one another? That's vertical diplopia, or are they stacked side by side? That's horizontal diplopia, or the images rotated in comparison to one another. Those details can help lead us to a diagnosis. For instance, in cranial nerve 3 palsy, that typically presents with a horizontal and vertical diplopia where the images are slightly displaced from one another but not rotated. Cranial nerve 6 palsy typically presents with a horizontal diplopia, and cranial nerve 4 palsy usually presents with some oblique or torsional diplopia because, like we said, your eye can't intort. All right, let's move to our first case. This is a 78-year-old female who presents with horizontal and vertical diplopia that improves with looking right and down, also having trouble keeping her right eye open. That's another good tip, too, asking the patient what the image looks like when they look through their range of motion. Is the diplopia the same in all right fields of vision, or does it change and improve depending on where you look? So here's the actual schematic, these ones that traumatize us from med school, right? If you forgot, this context, this is the patient looking directly at you in a neutral gaze, and then the cardinal directions looking up, down, left, right, and to the corners. So one thing you can appreciate from this first picture here is this right eye is not hanging out in midline. It's kind of hanging down and to the side, down and out. And also that right eye is not having much medial movement or deviation. Something you can also appreciate is he's having a little bit difficulty opening his eye, especially here on that right side. This patient has a cranial nerve 3 palsy, right? This can be pretty apparent on exam because most of your extraocular muscles are innervated by cranial nerve 3. So if cranial nerve 3 goes out, you have unopposed action by cranial nerve 6, that lateral rectus that pulls your eye out, and then also unopposed action of cranial nerve 4, which is responsible for intorsion, which kind of pulls the eye internally rotates it and pulls it down. So the classical appearance of patients with cranial nerve 3 palsy, the eye assumes a down and out position. We also mentioned a little bit earlier that cranial nerve 3 was really important, not only for its extraocular muscle innervation, but also the levator palpebrae. That can be an easy clue. If a patient's having trouble keeping their eye open because of ptosis, that may be because the cranial nerve 3 palsy lost innervation to the levator palpebrae. Like I said, pretty easy to detect on exam. Where do these palsies come from? Well, the vast majority of all these cranial nerve palsies, the biggest etiology are microvascular changes related to high blood pressure and diabetes, right? So you say, see these patients are over 50 years old, they have high blood pressure and diabetes. Most likely it's these microvascular changes that occur deep down in the nerve that takes out the motor function. But specifically with cranial nerve 3, there's another very important diagnosis that you need to consider anytime you see a new cranial nerve 3 palsy, and that is a compressive mass or lesion. Most commonly, or very commonly, is an aneurysm from the PCOM, your posterior communicating branch. So if you take a look right here, this yellow structure here, that's cranial nerve 3 running parallel with your posterior communicating artery. And right there, you can see that little aneurysm that's pressing on the nerve. And when you see that, when you have that compressive type lesion, so here's a kind of my mock-up of cranial nerve 3. You see deep down in the nerve, there's that deep vasculature, right? Those are very small vessels, and that's where all of your motor fibers to your cranial nerve 3 are, down deep. So if you're a person who's over 50, have high blood pressure and diabetes, have those microvascular changes, it's going to affect all those deep motor fibers in the nerve. But also important for cranial nerve 3 is you have your superficial parasympathetic fibers from your Ettinger-Westphal nucleus going to your ciliary muscles, and those are all on the periphery. So if you have somebody who has these microvascular changes deep down to the motor fibers here, it'll affect the motor fibers, but a lot of times those superficial parasympathetic fibers, they get enough blood flow from the perineurium, that connective tissue around the nerve, so that the folks who have high blood pressure and diabetes get the motor portion of the nerve affected, but not the parasympathetic, so they don't have any pupil involvement. So how can we summarize that? So two flavors of cranial nerve 3 palsy, pupil involving and pupil sparing. Anytime you see a cranial nerve 3 palsy, that's something that you should consider and look for. If you see an involved pupil, that means that parasympathetic fibers on the periphery have been involved, and that's usually due to something pressing down on the nerve versus a problem deep in those microvasculature in the nerve. Contrast that with an older gentleman with high blood pressure and diabetes that's been uncontrolled. They have a cranial nerve 3 palsy, the eye is down and out with ptosis. These are the patients that we think related to high blood pressure and diabetes. You know, and if that is the case, if you have a cranial nerve palsy related to high blood pressure and diabetes, usually the answer is to patch the eye, have them follow up with ophthalmology or neurology, and that function should return in about 3 months as long as you control your high blood pressure and diabetes. So even though that we reviewed that, and I want you to look, if you have a cranial nerve 3 palsy, I want you to look for pupil involvement. However, all new cranial nerve 3 palsies deserve some type of angiography. Really, you know, CT imaging, not great for diplopia, to be honest, but specifically for cranial nerve 3 palsy, these people need angiography, whether that's CTA or MRA, because we're trying to exclude a PCOM aneurysm. You know, studies have shown that pupil involvement is not a reliable indicator to exclude aneurysm or mass. So you may see that in ophthalmology textbooks that, hey, if the pupil's not involved, it's probably not an aneurysm we can follow up. We don't play that game in the emergency department. We want to rule out the bad stuff. So any new cranial nerve 3 palsy gets angiography, whether that's CTA or MRA. All right, our next case. We have a patient who presents with horizontal diplopia that's worse with leftward gaze. Again, I'm going to scar you with these eye schematics here. So what can we appreciate from this picture? So I'll draw your attention to this photo right here. This patient is actually trying to deviate their eyes to the left here. And you can see that her right eye is doing it, but her left eye, stay in midline, not abducting whatsoever. This is a cranial nerve 6 palsy, and this is also fairly easy to detect on physical exam as well, because these people can appear a little cross-eyed when they're doing their range of motion. Like I said, a single nerve, a single muscle innervation, they can't abduct the eye. Something interesting about cranial nerve 6, it has a relatively long course. You see it exiting the bottom of the pons, it goes curves up, and it's jumping this structure right here, which is your cavernous sinus. And the angle that it enters a cavernous sinus is pretty a sharp angle. that predisposes this nerve to increases in ICP or stretching. It doesn't like increased ICP, so in folks that have increased intracranial pressure, that nerve can stretch and you can get cranial nerve 6 palsy. One thing to think about if you have a patient who comes in and has bilateral cranial nerve 6 palsy, right? One thing that you should consider is intracranial idiopathic hypertension, right? So maybe even consider looking for papilledema in these folks. If you don't have papilledema and you are over 50 with high blood pressure and diabetes, like we said, most of these cranial nerve palsies that result in diplopia are a result of those microvascular changes. It's the exact same with cranial nerve 6. All right, our next case, a patient who presents. This patient has a torsional diplopia that's worse with downward gaze. Here's my kind of schematic mock-up. You don't really notice a whole lot there. When I talk about torsional or oblique diplopia, this is what I'm talking about. So one image seems stationary and the other one seems rotated in contrast to the other. Now we take a real look at their extraocular movements. I think this is the one that really scarred me from medical school. This is the one that's really challenging to diagnose. Even ophthalmologists can miss this cranial nerve palsy, which it's a little scary. Some things to point out here. So one thing is in primary gaze right here, one thing that you may pick up is his head is not neutral, right? His eyes are actually slightly off center, right? One's higher than the other. So even when you're telling him to look neutral, he's not. He actually has a slight head tilt. And when looking kind of to the left, his right eye can't intort downwards. This is a cranial nerve 4 palsy. Like I mentioned, it's the hardest to diagnose, right? It usually has a head tilt to reduce diplopia. And the causes, what causes a cranial nerve 4 palsy? Well, it depends on the reference that you utilize. So I know you probably think I can't do math, and that's why I realize it depends on which resource you look at. So highly associated with trauma, cranial nerve 4 is also a very, very long nerve, so predisposed to trauma. This can be congenital as well. You can have a cranial nerve 4 palsy all your life, and you didn't know. We talked about cranial nerve 4, right? It's that superior oblique that end towards the eye. So what happens if you can't intort your eye? It's kind of a minor movement. Well, guess what? I can still intort my eye by rotating my neck. So that's how these people get by and reduce their diplopia, especially if it's congenital. They just have a head tilt. So some references say if you have a patient with a cranial nerve 4 palsy, compare it to old pictures. If you have pictures of a kid and they actually have a slight head tilt, later in life you can have decompensate, you have a neck sprain, you can't tilt as well, and then you develop that diplopia. So it can be congenital. It can be ischemic like those other causes of cranial nerve palsies, right? Those microvascular changes can affect cranial nerve 4, or also tumor. So I wanted to kind of show you the cranial nerves in comparison to one another. I want to remind you about cranial nerve 3, right? Running in parallel with your posterior communicating artery. So if you have an aneurysm, it could easily press on there. Here you see cranial nerve 6 starting from that inferior pons, jumping up and then diving into your cavernous sinus with a very sharp angle. And then you see cranial nerve 4 right here with a pretty long course, so can be involved in trauma. That can be tricky, right? Because you have somebody who comes in with a polytrauma, they're altered. How are you going to pick up cranial nerve 4 palsy if somebody who is obtunded, intubated? You're probably not going to figure that out until after they wake up. So here's again showing you cranial nerve 3, cranial nerve 4 with that long intracranial course, very predisposed to trauma, and then cranial nerve 6 starting low in the pons and then with that sharp angle into the cavernous sinus that predisposes to injury with any increased ICP or stretching. So now you have a patient who presents with diplopia. You check, you do the cover-uncover test. It's binocular, but you still can't figure out what the heck their eyes are doing. They're doing crazy stuff. There's a few things that you need to think about if their eyes are doing funny things. One of those is think about where all your cranial nerves are running in one spot together. And a good place for that is your cavernous sinus, right? 3, 4, and 6, all there right in your cavernous sinus. You know, specifically think about this if you have somebody who comes in who has absent eye movements. Their eye's not moving at all, and they have loss of sensation on their brow or cheek. You should really consider cavernous sinus pathology.
Different strokes it takes. Different strokes it takes. Different strokes to move the world.
right, different kinds of strokes as well. We talked about these cranial nerves well back from medical school. You remember all of those nuclei and pathways are located in your pons and your brainstem. So if you have any sort of infarct, demyelination in your pons or your brainstem, that can take out multiple cranial nerve nuclei at the same time. So consider those things as well. I remember, it was probably a year ago, I saw a patient that got triaged for diplopia. My off-service resident went to see them, came and got me right away and said, "Dr. Williams, I think something's wrong with this person." I'm like, "Oh, okay." I go see the patient, and the patient's laying in bed and has a urinal and doing this. And I'm like, "What the heck is going on?" They have disconjugate gaze, have truncal ataxia, having trouble set up. I go to the nurse, I'm like, "Hey, what is up with this dude?" And she's like, "Oh, yeah, he had to use the restroom. I gave him a urinal." I was like, "Yeah, the guy ended up having a huge pontine stroke as well." So consider those things when the eyes are doing weird things. So the next case is probably one of my favorite neuro-opto diagnosis. So this guy, he came in, he's 65 years old. He's coming in because he said his eyes felt tired. For the past couple days, he's been noticing some diplopia resolves when he closes one eye, automatically increases our anxiety because bad things could cause that. But when I do his extraocular muscles, what I notice, well, first thing I notice is ptosis, right? A little bit of lid droop. That makes us think, ooh, could that be a cranial nerve 3 palsy? Well, I'm going to look. Is the eye down and out? Is there pupil involvement? Well, his eyes can move up and down just fine and no lateral movement whatsoever. Very interesting. So get some context from the guy. He says, "Yeah, for the past couple days, my eyes just have felt tired. I feel okay in the morning, but throughout the day, I start noticing some double vision, and it's hard to keep my eye open." This patient had myasthenia gravis. Super cool diagnosis. So myasthenia gravis is an autoimmune inflammatory condition where your body creates these autoantibodies to the acetylcholine receptors on your motor end plate. So what that leads to is decreased transmission of force and fatigability of that muscle. What's interesting is there's two subtypes of myasthenia that you may not be aware of. There's generalized myasthenia, which is what we typically think of, but then there's also ocular myasthenia that only affects your eye, only presents with diplopia and ptosis. The key finding in these patients with myasthenia gravis is fatigability. They have a decrease in their acetylcholine receptor on that motor end plate, and so as you start releasing and stimulating that nerve, you release acetylcholine, which then depletes, and so as long as you keep going, that acetylcholine gets depleted, and you have less and less force and more weakness, that rest typically improves. Is it surprising that myasthenia usually presents with ocular findings first? Well, it shouldn't be, because your extraocular muscles actually have the highest metabolic activity out of any muscles in your body. We use those babies a lot. So they can get fatigued moving around. So even myasthenia gravis, if it's not ocular myasthenia, can typically present with eye findings first. Myasthenia gravis is a great mimicker in neuro-ophthalmology. That's why it's my favorite, because it can be so tricky. It can present and look like a cranial nerve 4 palsy, a cranial nerve 3 palsy, or a pupil-sparing cranial nerve 3 palsy. How do you diagnose this in the emergency department? Another reason why I love myasthenia gravis, because it can be quite simple. You guys probably remember from medical school back in the day, the edrophonium challenge. Has anybody done an edrophonium challenge ever? Kind of curious. That's not something that we typically do in the emergency department. There are some risks, some bradyarrhythmias if you try an edrophonium challenge in these patients. But the sensitivity is only about 80%. Right? So you're going to do a test that has the risk of some bradyarrhythmias in the emergency department, and the sensitivity is only 80%, when you can do another test. It's called the ice pack test. Super easy. Everybody has ice in their ED. You can basically slap an ice pack on these people. It's helpful if they have ptosis as well. Put an ice pack. In 2 to 5 minutes, go check on the person. If the ptosis is resolved, if the diplopia is better, that's a pretty good sign this patient may have myasthenia gravis. So why the heck is that work, right? So it ends up acetylcholinesterase, that enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine in that motor end plate, is temperature responsive. In cold environments, acetylcholinesterase, that enzyme that breaks it down, doesn't work as well. So you put an ice pack on, that decreases that enzyme's activity. You have more acetylcholine in that motor end plate, and you get a stronger motor response. Quick and easy test, very low risk, and you can clinch the diagnosis. There's also some serologies you can send. I feel like this is mainly for neurology outpatient follow-up because they're not going to be back in a reasonable time. But anti-acetylcholine receptor antibodies, you can send those. For generalized myasthenia, that's actually pretty good, like 90% sensitivity. But for the anti-muscle-specific tyrosine kinase, is actually a little bit less. So not super helpful for us in the emergency department, but the ice pack test is. So now that you have the diagnosis, what are you going to do with this person? Well, if they had a good response to the ice pack test, you know, you can actually start pyridostigmine trial, usually 30 milligrams per day, TID, and then titrate up to effect. I probably would just start at 30 milligrams TID and have them follow up the neurologist. You can give them a dose in the emergency department as well. So pyridostigmine, it inhibits acetylcholinesterase as well, similar to how the cold treatment works, and you get increased transmission. You can start this and have them follow up with a neurologist with close outpatient follow-up in addition to steroids, 1 milligram per kilogram per day. If these people really are in a myasthenic crisis and it's not just ocular myasthenia, those patients, you may need to consider them for IVIG, NIFs, negative inspiratory force, and et cetera. What's also kind of cool, like I mentioned, the myasthenia is really cool. It's the syphilis of neuro-ophthalmology because it has a great mimicker. It can mimic lots of other things, but your pupil exam should always be normal with myasthenia. That can help you exclude other causes. And last but not least, probably my least favorite topic in neuro-ophthalmology, it's giant cell arteritis. You might have heard this previously referred to as temporal arteritis. The new updated name is giant cell arteritis. And the reason I don't like it is because this can be hard, if not impossible, to diagnose in the emergency department. You have to make a presumptive diagnosis, but there's no way for us to really exclude this in the emergency department. It's the most common large vessel vasculitis, and the reason that we don't call it temporal arteritis anymore is because any branches of the carotid can be involved. So if your lingual artery is involved, you can have tongue pain. If your facial artery is involved, you can have jaw claudication. If your retinal artery is involved, you can have vision loss and blindness. So it's an autoimmune inflammatory condition where you get this huge lymphocytic infiltrate into the media of your vessel wall that then kind of blocks the lumen. What makes this challenging as well is that you can have intermittent stuttering symptoms before you have permanent vision loss. Right? So as you get that increased inflammation, your lumen narrows, you can get some transient ischemia, and patients can have these stuttering symptoms. So they come in and say, yeah, I had diplopia yesterday. You're like, okay, but not now. So still need to have a high suspicion. And the thing is if we do miss this diagnosis, it's going to have catastrophic outcomes for these people, right? If they have retinal involvement, these people are going to go blind if we don't start steroids. So you need to think about giant cell arteritis. It's most common in elderly population, most common in female. The JAMA Rational Clinical Exam Series kind of looks at the accuracy of historical elements in the history and physical and found that the most common complaint in these people is headache. So you should probably consider this diagnosis in any elderly patient over 60 who presents with headache. Another kind of interesting thing I found reviewing this is that about 10 to 25% of these people who go on to have permanent vision loss had actually reported intermittent transient diplopia prior to having vision loss. Right, we have limited evaluative tools for this in the emergency department. To clinch this diagnosis, these people need a temporal artery biopsy, which we don't do in the emergency department. And we do have some serological markers that can try to help us. ESR and CRP, they're not perfect, though. There are cases of false negative, and you'd hate to have cause somebody to have a permanent vision loss from that. How high is too high of an ESR? So it's age over 2, or if you're a female, age plus 10 over 2 is the upper limit of normal. If you consider this diagnosis, we need to start high-dose steroids and have these patients follow up for a temporal artery biopsy. Another thing that's challenging about looking at this research is that in these studies, not everybody ends up getting a temporal artery biopsy. So how can you say? All right, guys. And then to review everything that we learned today, when you see these patients with diplopia, think monocular or binocular. If it's monocular, yay for you. We don't have to do a whole lot. We just send them to the ophthalmologist, which is great. Describe the diplopia. That pattern to the diplopia can help lead us to the diagnosis. Cranial nerve 3, the eye assumes a down and out position, also can have ptosis. All of these people need angiography to rule out a PCOM aneurysm. Cranial nerve 4, hard to diagnose, usually presents with a head tilt to reduce the diplopia, highly associated with trauma. Cranial nerve 6 palsy, think about increased ICP, especially if it's bilateral. If you have multiple cranial nerve involvement, think about weird stuff, different kinds of strokes, cavernous sinus pathologies. Myasthenia gravis is the great mimicker, but I love seeing this in the emergency department. It's a rare diagnosis, but it's so cool to make somebody better with ice and clinch that diagnosis. And if you see patients over 60 with vision change and dysplopia, consider an ESR and CRP. Consider starting steroids and have these patients follow up for a biopsy. If they already present with vision loss, this is high-dose steroids and an admission. And last slide, if you want a quick takeaway, this is basically the algorithm that I ran through with us today. So if you forgot everything I say, just take a picture and reference it. Thanks, guys. Enjoy the rest of your time in paradise.